Welcome to the Hay Matters podcast, brought to you by Local Ag and Feed Central. This is your go-to source for all things hay-related in Australia. I'm your host, John Paul Driver. In today's episode, we're joined by Marty Conroy. He is Agronomy Services for Northern Australia, representing Berenbrug. Welcome to the podcast.
G'day, John. Thanks for having me.
Now, tell us a little bit about Berenbrug.
Yeah, so Berenbrug's a pretty big company now, but it is a family-owned company that operates out of the Netherlands, out of Holland. It's operating over six continents at the moment, 22 different countries. We've got operating centres in. We employ over 1,000 people worldwide. And yeah, I guess the main focus is on grasses and also forages. So whether that be lucerns, legumes, right through to even sunflowers in some circumstances in some countries.
Oh, that's fascinating. But largely focused on pasture settings.
Yes. Yeah. I would say especially in Australia, 90% of the business would be pasture and forage. In other countries, there might be a bit of a shift in areas where there's, I guess, higher domestic demand. We do a lot of turf as well. It's a grass. It all fits in the same. But essentially, from the moment that Joseph Berenbrug started his grass journey back in the early 1900s, he essentially started Berenbrug as a company. And ever since then, we've been trying to perfect grass, I guess, is the ultimate goal of what we've been doing.
The thing about grass is it grows everywhere. It's just what species, right?
Yeah, it is one of the most versatile plants that we have on this planet. When you really think about grasses and you encompass all of your grass species, so that includes your barley, your sorghums, your corn, all of your species right through to ryegrass, to tropical grasses such as Rhodes grass or hybrid brachiarias. There is a range. There's pretty much, I think, the only continent they wouldn't grow on is Antarctica, and that's the only continent we don't operate on. So, yeah, they're everywhere.
You know, one of my goals in life is to find the northernmost hay producer in the world and the southernmost.
That'd be very, very interesting. Yeah.
I think, and I, not that I've spent a ton of time on Google Earth trying to find this, but I think the northernmost hay producer is in the very northern tip of Norway. And I think I can see silage bales in the Google Earth shots. And then the southernmost is a little trickier, but I think it's got to be Argentina.
Yeah, it'd have to be Argentina or New Zealand in between those two. Yeah. Either way, both of those guys do a really good job in all their pasture management and pasture utilization. Like I was looking at a presentation that was done on Berenbrug as a company there recently, and we're working out how much of an impact we actually have in global agriculture. Mm-hmm. And just some random stats was 2.1 million steers last year were finished in Argentina on our pasture systems.
Yeah.
There's 18 million homes in the US that have got the RPR turf or the turf range of Berenbrug's developed home turf range. And then 14.4 million sheep in Australia are finished on or enjoy Phalaris and lucerne pastures. So it's a huge impact when you start to talk about it as a global scale.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, one of my favorite things in the U.S., hay is actually the third largest crop after corn and soybeans. Mm. Wheat, rice, I mean, everything else comes after forage crops. And that's not counting any pasture, anything. So it is a huge, huge crop.
Yeah, and it covers a huge area too. Like, yes, you've got some very intense areas of pasture production and forage cropping. Mm-hmm. But when you encompass the whole rangeland area of not only Australia, if you include Africa, America as well, there's such a large area that really can't be utilized for much else outside of a long-term pasture.
Or the steppes in Russia. I mean, the Mongol hordes rode horses across vast open grasslands, right? Yeah. Okay. All right. Now we're really nerding out here, aren't we?
It's good to see someone enjoying grass as much as I do.
Oh, yeah. No, we're kindred spirits. I can already tell. Okay. Let's dive back into Australia. Where are we at in sowing or seeding for pasture?
So I guess it really depends on where you are. At the moment, I'm based in northern New South Wales, so I'm actually living in a little town called Warriolda. Not a very big town, but it's very close to Moree, if anyone's ever heard of Moree. But I guess it's right on the edge of the true wheat belt that encompasses all the plains to the west, but we get the luxury of a bit higher rainfall, a little bit more sloping country. So it's a very mixed farming area there. But we are really just getting into cereal crop planting now. So there's a lot of canola that's gone in the ground already, barley, wheat, chickpeas will be a little bit later, but winter crop planting is well underway. A lot of our oats and early forages that we want to get out of the ground quickly for that winter feed gap, a lot of those have already been planted. They start to go in pretty much from the 1st of March onwards. Really in April and May, we're looking at a lot of lucerne, or as you guys call it, alfalfa over there. Yeah, there's a lot of that going in the ground. I guess if you look at the area that I cover, which is northern New South Wales, Queensland, Northern Territory, in terms of planting, a lot of guys won't start planting forage oats or forage cereals until now in those northern regions, just because it starts to get a little bit cooler, those soil temps drop a lot. And that's for a really niche, either hay crop or a very, very niche finishing crop over that winter period to fill a specific feed gap. Most of those systems rely heavily on tropicals and subtropical pastures, which majority of those go in spring, so around September, or there's a bigger push to start planting them later with a bit more consistent rainfall, which rainfall is never consistent in Australia, but what we've found is we've had a lot higher successes choosing a later plant. So planting later summer, potentially even early autumn, depending on when your winter sets in and how harsh that winter is, if you get frosts or not. We're having higher likelihood of successes with establishing tropicals in that later window as we're going into the cooler part of the year.
That was a lot. Let's break down the more temperate varieties of grass versus the warm season grasses.
Yep. So our temperate grasses or our C3 grasses grow in cooler conditions. So I think in your part of the world, John, they grow over summer because it is quite mild in your part of the world and it freezes over in winter. So in Australia, we have a luxury that whenever we have rainfall, we can essentially grow something, no matter where we are on the continent, outside of probably some spots in Tasmania and some high altitude spots in throughout the Great Dividing Range. But essentially, the C3 grasses or your temperate grass species, you're looking at your Phalaris's, your cocksfoot, which is orchard grass.
Orchard grass, yeah.
Yep. Yeah, over in the States. Surprisingly, we've had a lot of prairie grass move in, especially in northern New South Wales. It's become a bit of a hit over here just because it seems to get up and get going and it has a high biomass production during that shorter season. The king of all your temperate species would have to be ryegrasses. So whether that be an annual ryegrass, an Italian ryegrass, or a perennial ryegrass.
And then on the warm season side, the C4 side?
Yep. So on the C4 side, which I guess they don't get talked about a lot in a lot of the agronomy stuff because they grow very quickly. And I guess there's a small part of the world that they're adapted to that has a lot of these, I guess, pasture systems are only still developing. A lot of tropical species have only had about 200 years or less of domestication, whereas things like ryegrasses have been bred and moved around the world for thousands of years. So they're still in early stages, but there is some huge scope and upside in the tropicals. But those species include Rhodes grass, Digitarias species, Penix, so that'd be Bambatze or your Megamax style Penix. And then there's also your decumbent species, so like your signal grass, your Paspalums, or your hybrid brachiarias. Technically, forage sorghum and grain sorghum and corn all fall into that as well. They're all a C4 pathway grass. That's the level of domestication of the sorghum. The forage sorghums and the grain sorghums are a hybrid, but that's a C4 grass as well. So they fit into that tropical, subtropical system.
Now, you strike me as somebody that actually knows the distinction between C3 and C4, and it has to do with the way the plant metabolizes sugars.
Yes, sugars, okay. Carbon.
Yes.
So essentially, all plants need they're like a solar panel. They need light energy to essentially feed themselves and create sugar for themselves. Mm-hmm. And I guess that is probably one process that we undervalue each day because everything we do, whether it be the wood in your house is part of that process or the meat that you're consuming at your high-end restaurant, it's all coming from that single process. So your C4 grasses have a slightly different pathway to convert your carbon dioxide to that sugar than your C3 grasses. Does it mean that they're any better? I deal a lot with C4 grasses. I like to think that they are. They're much more efficient at that process. So they utilize less water during that process to actually build up sugars and build up plant biomass. They also use less nutrients in that process, hence why you can get a Rhodes grass that can yield up to 27 to 30 ton a hectare in a 6 month season. Whereas a ryegrass, if you get it to do 14, you're doing pretty well. But in saying that, they've got two different distinct growing seasons. Your growing season for C4 grasses where you are would be extremely, extremely short. So it's,
we only have 90 days without frost. So
yeah, so it's not feasible. But in saying that, like I live right up in northern New South Wales and we live in a transition zone where I guess we could do both C4 and C3 grass as well or poorly, depending on how the season goes.
Sure.
There's a place for both of those grasses in a pasture system. And across the whole globe, there's definitely room for all of them.
Okay, let's change gears here a little bit and talk about any trends that you're seeing with what growers are asking for. Are they looking for quality, quantity, flexibility?
I think you just hit the nail on the head, all of those.
Yeah, of course.
Yield is king. And I guess it really depends on the farming system and its objectives. That's my job within Barrenbrug is to, I guess, extend the technical knowledge of the individual products to try to let guys make the most out of these products, so whether it be a C4 or C3 grass in their northern production system. When we start to talk about how do you set up a pasture system, what are the main factors? What are they trying to achieve? Yield is king, whether you're in a hay situation or if you're in just a forage grazing situation. But feed quality also plays into that, and it probably plays into that a lot more so than hay, but it's not talked about as much. It's certainly asked for. We want feed quality. We want quicker weight gains. We want quicker turnover of stock. We want our hay to be more accepted at the market. But one thing that it does do, the higher quality feed you have, the more you can physically fit into an animal. So the higher digestibility it has, the more energy you can get into that animal, the quicker you can finish it, the more weight you can gain, the more money you can make as a farmer. And if you've got a bit of a sustainability touch, the quicker that animal's off farm. So its rumination days go down and it's not ruminating as much because the feed is more highly nutritious. So it's not breaking down a lot of cellulose. You have a really, really good opportunity to improve your sustainability piece as well.
Focusing on fiber digestibility.
Yes. Majorly.
This is the thing that I'm screaming from the mountaintops is you have to understand your fiber digestibility.
Yeah. And it's a hard one too, because it's like everything. And I know there's plenty of people out there that love cattle genetics. And unfortunately, sometimes you don't get paid for certain genetics that you like. You just get paid on weight. And it's the same with hay. And sometimes it's the same with pasture. It's how much you can produce and how much does it weigh. But fiber quality or fiber digestibility or that feed quality overall really improves your ability to, I guess, utilize and maximize what you're doing, which even though there's a lot of land in Australia, or we like to think so, it's getting smaller every day, the actual land dedicated to agriculture production. So you need to produce more off less all the time.
Just a couple of things on the economics side. Lignin in forage has zero nutritional value, right?
Yep.
Okay. So low lignin numbers, good thing when you're looking at a forage test, right? Simple stuff to look at on forage tests. And then I like to look at the dry matter intake to your point.
Yep.
Dry matter intake is a calculated value based off of the fiber digestibility, right? But
yes.
But it helps you understand one forage compared to another as you're looking at feed tests. If one forage has a higher dry matter intake than the other, it also has better fiber digestibility. That tells you that animal will consume more.
Yeah, it can physically fit more through its rumen during the passage of the day. Yeah.
Yes, which allows you to do one of two things: get the same gain on less feed or more gain on the same amount of feed.
Yep. Even if the energy is exact same between the two, say, hay parcels.
Yep.
If you can physically fit more into that animal, you'll get a higher weight gain and a better return on your investment most likely, because if you're paying by weight and you're carting it, it's all the same cost per kilo.
What innovations in breeding, agronomy, management are you most excited about?
There's a fair few innovations, and I guess the pasture space is an interesting one. I come from a broadacre grains background during my formative agronomy years, and I saw a lot of gains in yield, diseases, those sort of things. With pastures, because you're not measured just so much on an endpoint yield, there's all these other factors that go into it. There's a huge area of development on how do you actually, I guess, shape a breeding program to deliver what the farmer wants. When we start to look at how those breeding programs shape up, we can start to look at, yes, yield is important, but are other things that we can really start to select on just as important or create a point of difference with a certain forage? So whether that be seasonal yield, so when does that peak yield actually occur during the season? Does that fill a specific niche feed gap that we're experiencing somewhere that a farmer is willing to go out and put in a new pasture species for? Because all these things cost money. It needs to be worthwhile to the grower. And I guess the biggest one that we've focused on within Barrenbrug is feed quality, trying to improve that quality to get more out of it. With the C4 grasses in particular, those breeding programs are relatively new. A lot of the original varieties, so like old Catanbora Rhodes grass, they weren't really bred. They were selected out of a cohort of a population. We're in the process now of having, I think it would be the largest Rhodes grass breeding program in the Southern Hemisphere here in Australia. We've also got a hybrid brachiaria screening program where we're looking at trying to get high quality and high yielding varieties. They're going to have adaptation across a range of environments because there's no point having the highest yielding tropical grass at Mackay that gets the most perfect conditions when this needs to be commercially viable across the whole of whether it be Queensland, Northern Territory, and Northern New South Wales. So I guess there's a number of factors that go into the breeding programs to try to deliver that. And that's why it does take a long time. I think it takes 12 to 14 years to deliver a new variety to the market. In terms of technologies, I guess, depending on where you're looking at, in the temperate space, we've been doing a lot of genomic work, and that's in collaboration with Dairy Bio. So the main focus on that is to deliver higher genetic gain, so three times the amount of genetic gain, so reduce that generational interval between varieties coming out, but also being able to have a complete genome sequence so we can start to pick and choose before we have to, I guess, phenotypically look at a variety and go, what is it doing? And working out, oh, where does it fit? We can then actually select varieties and do F1 hybrid crosses and going, these should produce high yield. This is what we want. This is the best disease package. This is what we want. And we can start to isolate those down. So that's, at the moment, which is pretty exciting, it's fully incorporated into our ryegrass breeding programs. It's moving across into our fescues and our other breeding programs that are dominated through France and also New Zealand as well. We've also got that technology being able to be adaptable to the C4 species because grasses are grasses, all plants relatively. There are different nuances within species, but those technologies can be moved across and the same adaptations can be used across different species. So utilising that information into the C4 grasses will be a huge step change technology. So yeah, tropical species generally are higher in fibre.
What makes you so excited about grasses?
I guess what makes me so excited about grasses is coming from the broadacre agronomy world previously in my last role, I saw how much gains they got each year. So if they were doing 1% better than the year before or 2% better, that was, you know, that small incremental gain was quite good for those guys, whether that be a breeding program or the actual farmer growing wheat or barley or sorghum. When it comes to pasture, like, there's huge gains to be made out there. The agronomy just isn't quite up to where we are with grains agronomy in Australia. There's also a lot of things that every farmer can individually do in terms of management to get more out of their pasture. There's no point us as Barrenbrug releasing a brand new variety that yields 10% more than every other variety on the market when it comes down to a farmer's management on how does he utilise and how does he get the most out of it. Similar with feed quality, trying to make sure that that's maximised. So I guess when it comes to myself and getting myself out of bed every morning, I look at the whole industry, especially the forage, the hay and the pasture industry. I'm blown away every day that we haven't made more gains quicker because I can see the opportunities out there for guys to make a lot more money and also to make it a pretty viable industry. There's a lot of area dedicated to pastures, to forage production, and I think no matter who we are in the industry or where we are, we can always be doing it slightly better. So that makes me really excited.
I likewise think that the low-hanging fruit in agriculture is actually around forages.
100%.
Yeah.
100%. You can get 20% out of the same paddock just by grazing it a little bit differently, implementing some rotational grazing, implement some strategies around fertilizer, anything like that. Any agronomy or management that you do to it, it's huge gains.
Nitrogen fertilizer on grasses is like the best investment you can ever make, providing it rains.
If I was talking to a mate that's in finance and he was talking about stocks and what they did over this last little bit, which obviously hasn't been very fun for him, but I was talking to him about the return on investment I get out of nitrogen for my winter forage program. And he was like, they're pretty good investment returns. I was like, yeah, it's a pretty good return on the dollars I spend on nitrogen. Funnily enough, talking about C4 grasses before, another thing that excites me about the C4 grass space is no true agronomy has been devoted to that space. There's been a lot around establishment. There hasn't been much around management. So actually grazing those varieties at the right time for the highest quality, for the highest weight gain. Same with the hay game, whether we're cutting it at the right time, making sure that our quality is paramount. How do we actually cut or graze for more yield throughout the whole season? Is it what's our grazing interval? What's our cutting interval for those more perennial species like Rhodes grass? But also when it comes down to the nutrient and water use efficiencies, as we go into a world where a lot of these things, I don't know if you saw it in the States, but we had certain years where fertilizer become very, very expensive and very short, like it was hard to get at key times like planting or at top dressing time. The C4 grasses do grow extremely well under low-end situations, and any N you give them, there's a huge response. They were getting responses, pretty much a linear response out of nitrogen application, up to 300 kilos of N, so 600 kilos of urea in QDAF trials, which QDAF's the Department of Ag in Queensland.
What species was this?
That was Rhodes grass. Economically, you wouldn't want to throw that much N in it, but knowing that there's a linear response in how much return in dry matter you get for the nitrogen you put out, they're very, very special plants that way. So
that's amazing.
Yeah.
Absolutely amazing. Okay, what's one piece of advice you wish every hay grower knew, but they miss all the time?
There's heaps. Like, there's always making sure that you soil test and fertilize and do all those things that your agronomist probably says for you to do that sometimes you think might be a bit difficult. But I think as a hay grower, really you're farming moisture and you're a business, so you need to be profitable. I'd be looking at benchmarking yourself against your neighbors or benchmarking yourself against an industry group or benchmarking yourself against yourself. How did I perform this year? And what are the things that I did during the year that I could change next year to make sure that I'm more efficient with the resources that I'm putting into this crop, whether that be water, fertilizer, money, because it's still a resource, to try to make more out of it. Increase, yep. Time, labor, yep. Big one. How do I make more out of less? Because unfortunately, they're not making any more land, and agriculture is very land dependent. So no matter what industry we're in, I think if we benchmark ourselves and we work out, right, how do we improve our efficiencies every year, we're on the right track to continue farming into the future.
I always tell producers to have their record keeping systems so they can answer questions for themselves.
Yeah.
That's the thing. Build out your systems so you can benchmark yourself.
Certainly. It's good to know where you go wrong. It's easy to have, you know, success in business and success in farming. Like, rain does that for everyone. But in those tougher years, you sort of go, gee, that wasn't what I was expecting. It was a bit disappointing. Sometimes they're the biggest learnings. If you haven't benchmarked yourself, you sort of can't go, right, where did I go wrong? What did I do? Yeah. Record keeping's part of that benchmarking process.
Absolutely. Thank you very much to Marty Conroy. He does agronomy services for Barenbrug in Northern Australia with a particular focus on C4 grasses and pasture systems. This has been wonderful. We've learned a lot. If somebody wants to get a hold of you, if somebody wants to contact you, how do they best find you to ask questions?
If they look up barenbrug.com.au, I'll be in the list of contacts there. I'm on all the publications that we do, so whether that be training manuals, product guides, all those things. I help develop a lot of those as well. Rob Winter, my counterpart in Southern Australia, does the more temperate species. other than that, Twitter. I'm on Twitter, pretty heavy on ag Twitter. Love posting photos. I think it's a great spot. There's always something you can learn on Twitter. Sometimes you don't want to learn half the stuff on there, but yeah, it's good.
Right. Well, with that, a big thank you, Marty, for joining us and sharing your valuable insights. This podcast is proudly presented by Feed Central and Local Ag. Stay tuned for upcoming episodes.